The British group Camel Music, inspired by Paul Gallico's book, The Snow Goose. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Gallico's book also inspired the man who was our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Our guest is writer William Fiennes. He's the author of The Snow Geese, A Story of Home. Fiennes first read The Snow Goose in school when he was about 10 years old. He came across the book 15 years later, while he was recovering from a serious illness. The book inspired him to learn more about the birds and their migration, and he decided to follow their migration from southern Texas to Canada's Baffin Island. The trip allowed Fiennes an opportunity to meditate on the push and pull of home and away. After being hospitalized, Fiennes was eager to return to the family home to convalesce and be cared for by his parents. But when he began to feel better, he began to strain against the confinement of home. Before long, Fiennes was, like the geese, on his way. Fiennes' book, The Snow Geese, A Story of Home, is a mix of memoir, natural history, and travel writing. The book is published by Random House. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Give us a call. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. William Fiennes, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
Sure. Well, tell us how during your convalescence you came across Paul Gallico's book.
Well, I as you say, I've rediscovered it really after about 15 years. I'd had this difficult period in my mid-20s. I'd had to go into hospital a few times, and I ended up having to pull out of graduate school where I was doing a doctorate and teaching, and really going to convalesce at my childhood home, which was in the country, right in the middle of England. And I had this strange kind of, as it were, second childhood, in that I was dependent on my mother and father. The whole world had contracted to the house and the garden, and I really couldn't think about anywhere outside of that miniature range. But eventually, after a few months, my mother suggested that we go and spend a weekend at a hotel really close to Wales on the Welsh borders. And it was one of those hotels that had a modern hotel, but the decor had been arranged to give the impression that it was a place of great history and moment. And of course it had a library, and it was a very strange library. It was one of those libraries where the books weren't for reading. They never had any idea that anyone would take a book off the shelf and read it. I think they'd been bought in sort of job lots, just as features of interior design, just to line the walls. But it was browsing in this strange library that I came across this book that I remembered from childhood, and that was really a trigger for a whole train of thought, which in a way intersected with another whole train of thought that had been set off by this period of isolation and confinement in this house that for me was the representation of everything that was familiar and known and safe and reassuring. And I suppose the whole idea of this book, The Snow Geese, really sprung out of that intersection of things, my feelings about home, and then this story about geese. And fairly soon I resolved that when I was strong enough and well enough, my way of kind of rushing back into the world was going to be to go and find snow geese in the Texas prairies. And when they started to head north with the spring, I'd go with them as best as I could. And really that journey is the sort of backbone of the book, although I think it's about a lot more than geese, really, but mm-hmm. That's certainly the backbone of it.
Yeah. You say in the book, when you reread Gallico's The Snow Goose, you were suspicious of the story's sentimentality, its glaze of religious allegory, but something in the story gripped you. What was it about the story that gripped you so? Maybe you could offer us a little summary of the story.
Well, for those of your listeners who don't know the story, it's I say it's a children's story. It has a kind of simplicity to it that's characteristic of children's stories, but it's a touching story, and it's really about a snow goose snow geese, as I'm sure you know, are North American birds. But Gallico writes about a snow goose that gets blown off course as it's migrating south from the Canadian Arctic. It gets caught up in a storm and carried across the Atlantic Ocean, and it's shot down by a hunter over a coastal marsh on the east coast of England. And this injured goose is brought by a young girl to a hunchback named Ryder, he's a painter of wildlife, and he's a hermit. He feels shunned by society because of his deformity, and he's gone to live in an abandoned lighthouse in this remote place. And he has a kind of local reputation for having a gift for healing birds, and he has a little bird sanctuary attached to the lighthouse where injured ducks and geese convalesce, as it were. And of course, all of this was striking chords with my own experience of convalescence and feeling that I'd been knocked off my course. I had this very acute feeling when I was ill, and perhaps other people who've been ill feel this, of the rest of the world kind of proceeding without you, that somehow you've been sort of sectioned off from the general run of things. I think that was the first chord that the book struck with me, is that here was this goose that had been knocked off its natural course, and had to be looked after and had to be helped back onto its feet and back onto its wings. Then the other thing that really struck me was the whole idea of the migration of birds, that somehow, and I didn't know anything about this at the time, although I was a countryman and I'd grown up in the country, I was a great walker, and I wasn't a biologist or a naturalist at all. But the whole phenomenon of bird migration, that there should be this inner signal, this restlessness that would prompt birds to depart from their breeding grounds at the end of the summer and to return to their breeding grounds at the end of the spring, seemed completely thrilling to me and amazing. And I immediately found myself wanting to know more about it. That was one thing. And then the other thing was, of course, when I was very ill and frightened in hospital, that was really, for me, a situation of total unfamiliarity and strangeness. It was as if the ground were kind of shifting under my feet, and all the things that I took for granted were suddenly up in the air and suspended. And I remember feeling at that time this sort of desperate desire to go home. And I thought of home as I thought of my childhood home as my home, even though I hadn't lived there for several years. I'd gone away to university. I was a graduate student. I was working. But I suppose it was that idea of home as a place of refuge or sanctuary that really gripped me. Yet, of course, after 6 or 7 or 8 months of confinement in this place, another longing began to nag at me, which was the longing for the new and for the undiscovered and the different, for strange horizons. And I suppose I felt that tension between the longing for the known and the longing for the new, and the way my impulses, and perhaps all of our impulses to some extent, shuttle back and forth between those two poles. I imagine I found that, as it were, dramatized in the flights of birds to and from these winter and breeding grounds. So the book just, it did haunt me on many levels, and it really set off this, in part, a project of self-education that then became a kind of rite of passage for me, a way of exploring my relationship to home and the whole idea of home and what the longing for home might actually mean.
Mm. So you're 25, 26 years old, and suddenly you're interested in birds. Yes. Were you surprised by this new interest? Did you go, well, who would have thought?
Funnily enough, it seemed actually that it had just been waiting to happen, and I'm surprised it hadn't happened earlier. As I said, I'd grown up in the country. Both my mother and father were real outdoors people. My father, before he retired, was a land agent. He used to look after people's farms. His life was farms. We used to go for walks every day. A day that we didn't walk several miles wasn't really a full day. Something would feel awry. But although I was an outdoorsman, a countryman, I wasn't a naturalist in as much as I wasn't concerned with giving names to species and distinguishing one thing from another by naming it. And it was really that appetite. It was the sort of urge to be a naturalist and to put names to things and be able to distinguish all the different things in the world that really erupted at that time. And I think in a way it was about that time that my desire to write stories. Well, I'd been writing for a while before that, but really this sort of serious sense that I wanted to sort of make written work, that was also beginning. And in a way, the writer's desire to match names to things and the naturalist's desire to match names to things, I wonder if they're related in some way. And so it was, in some ways, the book recounts, you know, the birth of a naturalist, or at least it recounts a sort of opening of eyes to all the things there are and the great variety of them.
Yeah. Now, your father is a bird watcher. What led him to his interest?
Well, he'd grown up in a kind of pre-television era where there was much more incentive to find your own recreations and get outside. And it had come actually particularly from his grandfather, who was a great bird watcher, who taught him the names of the different species, and they'd go egg collecting together. And I remember that they had this rule that if there were three eggs, you could take one, and that was allowed, but you couldn't take any more than that. So he'd really grown up as a naturalist, and it was certainly to him that I suppose I turned for my, really when I was beginning really to name the very common species. I mean, I knew the sort of the commonplace garden birds, but it was Dad who first said, look, this is called a something. And when I got excited, I would wander around the garden and I would borrow his binoculars and I would say, look, I saw this bird, it had this color wing, this color head, and what do you think it would be? I just remember this desperate, I suppose it was part of a feeling of revitalization, having recovered, or at least partially recovered, and a sense of being hungry for the world, and that this was a way of gulping it down, was learning what the plants were called and the birds were called. It became a kind of pressing need for me. It may also have had something to do with this sense of the chaotic that I felt being ill, of everything kind of swirling around and nothing being certain and fixed and nothing being predictable anymore. And I suppose to assimilate these names and be able to say this is a this and this is always a this, you know, was in some way a way of getting a hold on the world again and getting some bearings back. And all of those ideas of getting your bearings and feeling in place in the world are really the sort of central ideas of this book, The Snow Geese.
Yeah. So there's a restlessness going on, and that's a restlessness that we find in migrating birds. They have a migratory restlessness.
Well, they do. They have this, which the biologists call, they use this German word, Zugenruf, migratory restlessness, and it is an amazing phenomenon. And it was really the first sign that the homing instinct or the bird's capacity to navigate from one place to another might be inherited rather than simply a learned behavior. Because various biologists found that when you kept a migratory bird in a cage and you kept it under constant environmental conditions, that is constant day lengths, constant temperatures, it would still come into migratory condition and start to get restless and try and fly and run into the sides of its cage at exactly the same time as birds of the same species were starting to migrate in the wild. And later it was discovered that not only did birds have this kind of inherited program, this time program, but they also had some kind of directional program so that birds wouldn't only get restless in a cage, but they'd get restless in a particular direction. Yes, inevitably that restlessness, that urge to go was something that I was haunted by again, although I was always careful not to sort of compare my wanting to get away into the new with a bird's migratory behavior, which has obviously evolved for very particular reasons that to do with the availability of food resources in different places and the world circling the sun and the changing seasons. And one of the stories the book tells is actually that story of on a sort of, I hope, accessible level, the hows and whys of what birds are doing as a kind of counterpoint or sort of parallel narrative to what this narrative figure is going through.
Hmm. Well, tell us about the snow geese, their life cycle. When do they begin their migration north?
It's normally at the end of February, towards the end of February. But they'll go kind of sooner or later, depending on the weather. They're very sensitive to the weather. And really they head north at the leading edge of the spring, and they push as far north as they can until it gets too cold and the lakes are frozen ahead of them. Sometimes you can actually see them flying southwards when they ought to be flying north. And that's probably because they've flown up to try and get further north, but actually they've found that there's a cold snap ahead, or that the lakes are still frozen, the food's still frozen up. And then they'll track back a little, undertaking what's called a retreat migration. And then they'll wait up and they'll wait for the thaw to proceed and the spring to proceed. And this is happening all across North America. I mean, there are four major populations of snow geese across wintering in the southern United States and migrating up to the Canadian Arctic, right the way from Wrangell Island in the west to Baffin Island in the east. And they'll head off, as I say, at the end of February, and the whole kind of migration period will really take place over about 4 months until sort of June. Some birds will arrive in their nesting area much sooner than that because they'll nest further south. The particular birds that my book follows, which is really the sort of mid-continent population from Texas across the Midwest, across the Great Plains states, up into Manitoba and then across to Hudson Bay, quite a lot of those birds will nest around the coast of Hudson Bay, and then some might go on further up to the Canadian Arctic islands.
Mm. How fast, how high, how many hours a day do they fly?
They fly pretty high. I think it's about 2,000 or 3,000 feet on average, which comparatively isn't particularly high. I mean, there are some birds in Asia that fly over the Himalayas. Some birds that have been found at unbelievable heights. As for speed, I think they average. This is in the book somewhere, but I can't remember all the data in the book.
Well,
but I think it's around 45, 50 miles an hour, something like that.
Yeah, 55.
55. Yeah.
There is a wonderful amount of detail, and it is not at all tedious. It's a pleasure to read. By the way,
I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. And this trip, I mean, it's so amazing to think about these birds making this trip. You know, they've got when they finally set down at their destination, they've got to be worn out.
Well, I think, funnily enough, they're less worn out these days than they used to be, because of the way that we've changed the landscape. I mean, really now the whole of the Great Plains states have been, certainly since the Second War, have been developed, agriculturally developed, particularly for rice. And so the geese have learned to feed on spilled grain, on waste grain. So basically they now have a continuous supply of food from Texas right up to Manitoba, right up to the spruce forests of the boreal forests of Canada. So they're much fatter and in better shape when they get up to their breeding areas than they ever used to be. And the result is that there's actually quite a major problem with overpopulation of snow geese.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be that geese would only winter really in a very narrow band close to the Gulf of Mexico, because they would feed on the salt marshes and the grasses right on the coastal edge. Whereas now they're wintering much further north because again, as I say, their eating habits have adapted, and they're eating spilled grain. And they're clever too in that seem to have learned how to use the national wildlife refuges as ways of avoiding being picked off. So you get the most enormous flocks gathering at certain staging areas in the NWRs. And at one stage in the book, I talk about flocks of 250,000 birds, which is quite a sight.
Yeah. What does that look like? What does it sound like?
Well, in a way, it's actually the sound that's almost more overwhelming and impressive than the birds and than the actual sight of the flock. I remember them particularly huddled together, standing on the ice, and they would huddle together. This would be an evolved behavior. If they were in a group, they'd have a lot more eyes open to watch out for bald eagles, which would be on the lookout for any loose bird outside a group. And whenever there was any sign of danger, cars going by or people getting too close or bald eagles appearing, the whole flock would just lift off the ice as if it were a single entity. And your whole field of vision would be filled with this sort of blizzard of birds, predominantly white birds with black wingtips, although there'd be blue-phase birds mixed up in them. Which is, the snow geese come in two, what's known as color phases. There are blue-phase snow geese, which have this kind of slaty metallic blue color, and white-phase snow geese, which are all white with black wingtips. And you just get this blizzard. Sometimes I thought of it like the interference on a television screen. It would just be this pixelated frenzy of black and white points. And there'd be this incredible enveloping, enwrapping sound, sort of steel being hammered on anvils, trains thundering through tunnels. These were the kind of images that came to my mind. I would just stand there with my jaw hitting the floor. And it was, I suppose, additionally strange for me and sort of exciting for me, because in the U.S. these aren't exotic birds. They're maybe for many of your listeners they're quite commonplace birds, whereas for me I'd never seen a snow goose before. I didn't know what a snow goose was. It had this rather kind of poetic name. And so the whole thing had an extra strangeness and exoticism to me. And I hope that might have helped me perhaps convey these scenes in the book in words. But somehow transcribing those experiences into words was quite a challenge.
Mm. William Fiennes is our guest this afternoon. He's a writer. He's the author of The Snow Geese, A Story of Home. After convalescing from a serious illness, he followed the migration of snow geese from Texas to Canada's Baffin Island. And the trip allowed him an opportunity to meditate on the push and pull of home and away. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. Join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. You met so many interesting people along the way of this trip, and you also were fortunate enough to be able to stay with people in their homes, and your description of places that are homes is very good, and it's a very interesting part of the story. It makes one reflect on the meaning of home and what makes home home.
Well, this was definitely an aspect of making this journey that was interesting to me, and the book does present a series of places that are sort of prototype homes, or at least temporary homes, and I suppose that was a way for me to think about what features of a place actually made it a home, and I suppose in the book it's to do with ideas of continuity and consistency, constancy, things being the same from one day to the next, fixed landmarks so that you could find your way around a house in the dark, that sort of thing. Although increasingly, I suppose my sense of what home is became much more abstract and amorphous. I very quickly realized that home didn't have to be a particular house or even a particular spot of ground, that you could be at home in many different ways. But it was an enthralling part of the journey was the various characters encountered. Although I haven't written the book as a kind of ship's log or a diary, it's not a sort of this happened today and then this happened today and this happened today. It's more of a kind of imaginative work where I've chosen, I suppose, to foreground certain characters because the stories they tell in some way resonate or echo with the themes of the book, with the sort of human longing that's at the heart of it. But I did have some amazing encounters, and an ex-nun,
yes,
tennis player and lover of laundry, who I met on a Greyhound bus, and a Canadian man who'd run away from home in the late 40s, run away from Montreal and jumped the freight trains and lived as a hobo and lived in the hobo jungles and the Salvation Army hostels and traveled back and forth across Canada on the freight trains, and he pretty much talked my ear off for 36 hours nonstop. He said that in school, when they'd been doing the vaccinations, they jabbed everyone else with a vaccination needle, but when they got to him, they'd run out of needles, so they jabbed him with a gramophone needle instead, and that's why he couldn't stop talking. But all of these people told stories that were about this kind of this home quest that was really at the core of the book, this quest to be where you belong and to find your place in the world, which is, I suppose, really at the heart of the book. But yes, I felt incredibly lucky, and I benefited from the kindness of strangers and found myself staying in cabins in the boreal forest of Manitoba, and And that all becomes quite an important part of the book. These sort of quasi homes, these almost homes, mm-hmm. that the journey takes me through.
And even the bus, even though it's rolling along, the Greyhound is kind of a home.
Exactly, because you get to know your way around it, and certain aspects of it become familiar, and that familiarity is itself reassuring and a way of orienting yourself in space and time. So there's a whole chapter just takes place aboard a Greyhound, although with many diversions and digressions. And likewise, there's a long train ride from Winnipeg in Manitoba right up to Churchill on Hudson Bay, which is a 36-hour kind of two-night train ride. And that's another place that is one of these sort of temporary homes, as the geese are flying overhead towards their breeding grounds. There's always this sense of the birds going overhead, heading north, following that ancestral urge, which was so extraordinary and so interesting to learn about and to be thinking about at the same time as the other things that the book's about, you know. Mm. It has these various kind of parallel or intertwined narratives in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it moves so gracefully back and forth, and I think it keeps readers turning those pages. Let's go to Canada, if we may. What's Cape Dorset like?
Cape Dorset is an Inuit community, a predominantly Inuit community, on the southwest tip of Baffin Island. And Baffin Island lies across the Arctic Circle. Cape Dorset numbers about 1,000 people, about 95% Inuit. The language there is predominantly Inuktitut, which is the Inuit language. And this was really my final kind of destination. And Dorset to me, and the bare tundra all around Dorset, really represented something that was the total opposite or antithesis to my home place, in that it was totally strange to me. The landscapes were totally unfamiliar. There were almost 24-hour day lengths, so it was very hard to sort of fix myself in the daily cycles that I was otherwise used to. I couldn't understand what people were saying around me. I didn't know the language. So for me, it was a place of real strangeness. But again, people were very kind to me there. And the book really ends with a hunting trip I make going out over the tundra on two snowmobiles with an Inuit lady and her son, going off for 3 days to hunt geese and shoot geese out on the tundra. Being in Dorset was a strange experience for me. I mean, it has this strange English name. You know, it was named by an English navigator in the 17th century. And yet it was so un-English. The colors that you associate with England, all the deep saturated greens, the varied greens of England, were nowhere to be seen. It was white. It was whiteness and little flecks of black granite and this deep, infinite, voluminous blue sky. So really, I suppose that the arc of the book is from a place of complete familiarity to complete unfamiliarity. And that's sort of important in the shape of the book, the way it travels from one to another.
Yeah. You write about this feeling of being in a very, very strange place. Mm-hmm. And I just want to share this excerpt. It left me dazed, dreamy, dumb, and for a moment it was as if we were traveling across the middle of a page with whiteness and black markings all around us and geese lifting off the snow like letters coming unstuck. This is when you're traveling with Paula and her son, the hunters, you're traveling through the tundra on a snowmobile.
And quite often we were actually traveling across the sea. We were traveling across the frozen Hudson Strait, where the ice would be much flatter, so you'd get a good run on the snow machines. And that really did have this strange feeling for me, because my head was sort of constantly full of words, and I was, you know, my mind was constantly generating words. It was this strange feeling of going across a page. Here was this huge space of flat, open whiteness, and there'd be these flecks of black granite and sometimes ravens, which would just give you this, you know, these black markings. And there was this sense that if you were somehow in a kind of incredible voyage sort of a way, miniaturized and standing on this plane, it would be like, it'd be like standing in a book. And I suppose at the back of my mind was the idea that the whole story and the whole journey had really begun in a book. It had begun in the Snow Goose, discovered in this library. And here it was in some way ending up in black and white again. That was a haunting image for me.
Mm. Was there a place in the U.S. or Canada where you felt, I'd like to come back, or maybe even, you know, I could settle down here?
That's an interesting question. There are places I would like to go back to, I suppose, perhaps because of the people I met. Although a lot of the places I was going through were quite remote and isolated, and I felt out of my element in some way. And in a way, that gave rise to a lot of the inquiry of the book: is what does it mean to be in your element and out of your element? I met some amazing people, some very kind people. I remember a biologist in South Dakota who really taught me about ducks and taught me about North American birds. And I would be drawn back to see people like that. But I don't think I would settle in any of the places I went through. They were too far from my roots. I suppose the book in some way is an inquiry into what it means to have roots and to what extent roots are important in a life and to what extent they can be things that hold you back. I mean, rather like an anchor. An anchor is wonderful to have in a storm or overnight when you're trying to spend the night in a harbor. But an anchor is actually the one thing you don't want when you're trying to sail out into the open sea. And I suppose a very strong attachment to your first places or to your ancestral places in a way can be a sort of double-edged sword. It can give you a strong sense of where you come from, but it can also perhaps be a kind of encumbrance as you try and make your own way into the place you ought to be getting to. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. You stayed a couple of days in Austin with a wonderful woman named Eleanor, the mother of a friend, and you hadn't intended to stay more than one night, but you did. And your tour schedule now has you in Austin on Friday. Were you going to look her up?
Yes.
Good.
Funnily enough, I'm going to stay with her. Yeah, I'm going to Austin, and that's going to be very poignant for me going back there. I mean, the story, although it starts with the discovery of flocks of geese on the Texas prairies south of Austin, in a way, it's Austin itself where I first kind of find my feet in America and where I first have this experience of another home, of an alternative home or a temporary home on the way. And the house described in Austin, I suppose I describe in some detail because I'm suddenly aware of, the details that had for me spelled my own home. I suddenly see how just the things in this house would spell that sense of belonging to the people who lived in it. So it was a very important place for me and an important place for the sort of the narrative of the book, the story. I'm looking forward to going back there.
Yeah.
I really am.
We have a caller waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line. Let's go and talk with this listener. Good afternoon.
Oh, am I the person?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I wanted to get to that, the subject of the population explosion of the snow geese.
Mm-hmm.
For example, about 3 weeks ago, I saw a flock of about 10,000 of them here in central Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
It was extraordinarily large for this area. 20 years ago, a flock of 100 would have been considered a large number. And the Fish and Wildlife authorities finally have come to the realization that the damage they're doing in the tundra, you know, it's irreversible and that something has to be done about this problem. And their solution is basically to institute a policy of essentially no holds barred. In other words, it's now legal to shoot snow geese over a period of about 2 months in the spring, and all kinds of methods that are considered to be unsportsmanlike for other waterfowl are okayed. Electronic bait,
right,
or attraction of the birds.
No, I was hearing.
Pardon?
Sorry, go on. Yeah.
Well, my question was, can you think of, or has anybody suggested any more humane and reasonable methods? I agree that population does have to be reduced, but the kind of methods that they want to give the hunters seem to me.
Well, I agree. I think it's a really difficult situation. But I was the stories you're telling about these very large flocks. I was hearing stories like that when I was traveling with the birds a few years ago,
yeah.
And it was already a big issue. I mean, the problem, particularly with snow geese, is that they're not grazers; they're grubbers. They actually pull up grasses by the roots, so it does take a lot longer for the habitat to regenerate and for the foliage to regenerate. And when you get so many of them, they strip the ground bare along the coastal marshes of Hudson Bay, and that has then knock-on effects on lots of other species of birds that rely on the same habitat. So it really is a problem that needs to be faced, and it's a problem that was ironically initially caused by human intervention in the landscape. And when I was traveling, there were quite a lot of different loosenings in the hunting regulations. I mean, I even saw hunters' hides had actually been set up on national wildlife reserves in order to, I suppose, make some attempt at reducing numbers, although just giving hunters more of a free rein I don't think is going to make much of a dent on the great numbers we're talking about. I mean, I'm not a professional biologist or conservationist, so I don't really feel qualified to tell them what they should do about it. But it is a kind of difficult balance.
Yeah, it's
right.
Kind of a confounding problem. Right, very early in the book, you meet a man, Ken, and his grandfather Jack, and Jack's place is designed to attract waterfowl, although Jack himself realizes there's too many of these birds.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he loves the waterfowl, but yet, you know, I sort of have this sense that from time to time he curses them.
Well, there has been this amazing explosion, and really since the Second World War, and it has a lot to do with the development of agriculture and particularly rice farming. It is a very difficult situation. I can't suggest a solution really, but you know, I think whatever the solution is, it's going to be a lesser of two evils kind of solution rather than something that's wonderful for everybody concerned. You know?
To wrap up here, and we're out of time, so we've got to wrap up. Sorry to say, how did London feel to you when you returned?
Very small, you know. these huge open spaces of North America, we don't have that in England. It's like a toy country when you get back from the tundra of Baffin Island or the Great Plains. But again, there was something very reassuring about the familiarity of England. The something reassuring about the familiarity of its proportions, you know. Mm. But what really overwhelmed me about going back to England was the greenness, was the colors. I got back in the middle of June. It was the height of summer. The trees were in full leaf. There was just green everywhere. It was this complete overwhelming greenness, verdure, you know, this just assaulted me. Having been in this almost monochrome Arctic landscape, the return was very strange, yeah.
And as good as the going. William, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
William Fiennes has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Snow Geese, A Story of Home. The book is a mix of natural history, travel, writing, and memoir. It's published by Random House.